This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Julian Ng, and on the Breakfast Grill today is Dato' Saifuddin Abdullah, Minister of Foreign Affairs. And Dato' Saifuddin is also the Member of Parliament for Indra Makota and also Chief Secretary of Pakatan Harapan. Previously, he was Deputy Minister of Higher Education and Member of the UMNO Supreme Council. Good morning, Dato'. Welcome to the grill.
Well, good morning. Thank you for the invite.
So 1 year after the historic win of Pakatan Harapan in the last general election, Dr. Mahathir has rated the cabinet 5 upon 10. How do you rate your own performance and that of your ministry, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs?
Well, I'm not in the position to rate myself, and I won't do it. But I leave it to the public. But in as far as the Wisma Putra is concerned, our major story this time is that we have come up with a proper framework for foreign policy, something that the ministry have not been doing for quite a long time. So at least we have something on paper that we can share among ourselves and among other with other agencies as to what are our strategies, what are the things that we want to do. Even though most of the content of the framework are like motherhood statements, but at least we know exactly what we want to do. For example, we have decided and we have informed everyone that economic diplomacy is going to be one of the cornerstones of our work. We have been doing economic diplomacy all this while, but it is not something that we do. And we tell people that among the so many agencies, we will work more closely with MITI. And this is, of course, not to say that we are not going to work with primary industries or we're going to work less with Ministry of Youth and Sports, but because we know exactly what we want to do, and we say and the cabinet has agreed on our framework that we should work side by side with MITI. And that is a conscious statement.
Okay, we want to see how this foreign policy framework would play out in actual day-to-day situations now with regards to that relationship with China. It has been largely quite testy over the last year since Pakatan Harapan took power. And this is mainly due to expensive projects like the ECRL, for example. And the ECRL has now been renegotiated. It used to cost $65.5 billion and even higher. And now it's been come down by about $21 billion to $44 billion. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some insights on how you would deal with a powerful nation like China who look like they won't, they're not in the business of backing down on anything?
You must give this to Dr. Mahathir. When we came in, we decided that we need to renegotiate. We need to cancel one or two projects, and then we want to renegotiate ECRL agreements. In his first trip to China, in his first bilateral to China, he went again recently for the BRI. I think he was very firm in the way he dealt with the premier and the president of China, told them straight in the face, we are a new government, we want to be friendly with you, we want to have a stronger ties, we want to trade with you, but there are certain things we need to renegotiate, and including ECRL. And thereafter, there was, of course, Tun Daim played the most important role in leading the negotiation team. And we finally get what we want. And it was, to me, it's a win-win situation. Beijing is happy about it. And Kuala Lumpur is happy about it. But to be able to, you know, inform his counterpart and the Chinese president that we need to deal and renegotiate, I thought that was something quite so
as,
big.
Okay, so as far as the ECRL is concerned, what is the objective here? Are there actual benefits to the ECRL, or are we trying to go for the second best option, which is not to offend China?
I think they are both. One is diplomatic. We want to be friendly with China. And we know that China is big and we are just a small country. But number two, sometimes when you are, you have to decide. You have to make good with whatever that is in front of you. Yes, maybe if the current government were to be given the opportunity, I mean, if you were to go flashback and we were the one who decide whether we want ECRL or not, we may say we may not want it. But now it is there, you might as well make full use about it.
So the first choice is actually not to want it.
Well, I didn't say that. And yeah. We were not there during that time when we first negotiated about it. But given the current situation, the debt that we are faced with, we probably not include ECRL as something that we want to do. But now it is already there. Another way of looking at it, when we first came in, we freeze a lot of things, especially in business. And some people were not very happy. And I understand exactly why they were not happy with us. But we have to freeze things because we need to do some kind of due diligence. Yes, I wish we were, more quick in, allowing things to go. But after 6 months, I think things are now back in motion. And I think the business are happier now. The business sector, they see that we do certain thing in a certain way. And in many ways, we are different from the previous administration. But I think the principle that we are holding to is whatever contract that was already awarded, we may not like it. Let's face it.
Mm-hmm.
But these are contracts. No, and for you businessmen, it doesn't matter to you whether this is a BN government or a PH government. It is a Malaysian government. So we have to honour the contract. All what we do for the past 1 year is, for many of those contracts, is to do due diligence, to renegotiate. Bandar Malaysia is another example.
Mm-hmm. And high-speed rail to Singapore as well.
Exactly. HSR, we actually postpone it. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because it is a contract between two countries. You can't go to Singapore and say, brother, we cannot do this because you signed with the previous administration. I don't think that's how we do things.
But also in a recent press statement, Tun Daim said that the ECRL would continue to bleed for years, in his words. And there are some figures that have been thrown out there. The operational costs are an unknown quantity. In fact, can possibly cost tens of billions or more. Could we have challenged the ECRL in the courts, citing corruption as a means to legally cancel the project?
Well,
because this kleptocratic case is going on around the world, right?
There are two things here. Number one, yeah, we can win a court case. But remember, there are also Malaysians, businessmen and men on the street who actually want to see ECRL take off. It so happened that I am an MP for Indramayu Kota, the only parliamentary constituency, with four ECRL stations.
Wow.
You see?
So are you for or against?
Well, if you ask me, at the time when we started negotiating, I may say no. But now, I need to balance between what my constituent want. I'm not saying everybody wants ECRL. But if you imagine, Pahang and Kuantan is the capital, and the new administration center for Kuantan, for Pahang, is going to be Pusat Pentadbiran Sultan Ahmad Shah. And that's right in the middle of my constituency in Indramayu Kota. There's an ECRL station right beside it, planned to be right beside it. All right? And when they design this new administrative center for Pahang, it was with a view that there is ECRL station there, you see. So imagine the expectation. Now, I'm not saying that it was wrong or it was right, but, you have built that kind of expectation. And so when we say ECRL is going on, though it's like a no-frills flight, ECRL. But people in Pahang are very happy. And how do you tell them otherwise if you say, no, we are going to cancel? Yes, there will be others who are happy because they think we will save a lot of money. But it's a balancing act that we have to do.
We have on the Breakfast Grill this morning Dato' Saifuddin Abdullah, Minister of Foreign Affairs. And we're going to take a break right now. And when we come back, we'll have more discussion on this. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
This morning on the Breakfast Grill, we have Dato' Saifuddin Abdullah, Minister of the Foreign Affairs. And Dato', earlier on, what you said about the ECRL was food for thought. And I'm paraphrasing here. If we had to do it again, we might not go through it. But a lot of your constituents are happy about ECRL's revival. But then again, sometimes what we want, we can't pay for. So do you think that big projects like ECRL and even some of the other potential projects under the wider Belt Road Initiative by China can put countries like Malaysia into a debt trap?
You see, when we attended the BRI conference recently, one of the popular comments that I heard from delegates is that they were asking Malaysia as to how do we manage to renegotiate ECRL. And I think, I'm sure you know where they were coming from and why they were asking that question. And I think this is something that is really up to China how they look at it. It is not a secret that countries like Sri Lanka, for example, and there are also other countries who might have suffered from certain agreement or certain arrangement. And likewise, we were very steadfast in holding to our principle that whatever agreement that we do with China, and for that matter with any other foreign countries, must be principled, must be based on rule of law, and should not be lopsided. We must avoid any elements of corruption and so on. Where we heard a lot of stories around the ECRL arrangement, which among others involve, say, for example, the 1MDB scandal and so on. But yeah, I mean, we know all those things. But as far as we were concerned, we want to renegotiate, and I think we did quite well.
You don't think this will put us into some kind of a debt trap, Dato?
Well, we are already in debt trap. I think we try to minimize whatever problems that we have to face.
To a lot of analysis, the math don't actually work out.
Well, I think they have their point. I'm not saying I'm in agreement or I disagree with them. I mean, that is one of the view that we look at. But again, for practical purposes, here you are dealing with China. You are dealing with a country who is willing to buy more palm oil. That's the fact. Yeah. So sometimes when you negotiate, there is always this plus and minus thing. And I think we try to limit our loss, I mean, if I can put it that way, our debt, and we try to manage.
And China also has overt ambitions in the South China Sea, and you have commented on this. You said that every time we meet your counterpart in China, you have to be practical. Does being practical mean kicking the can down the road in solving the problems that are in existence in the South China Sea?
There are two things about the South China Sea. Number one, China's claim is really overboard. I mean, claiming the whole of South China Sea belonging to China, stating that it is, you know, because it is called South China Sea, then, you know, we were jokingly saying, look, if what would happen if India were to claim the Indian Ocean as belonging to India? I mean,
it's no different from the kind of colonialist practices that we've seen in the past, right? They just can claim for no reason at all.
Yeah, and they want to exert themselves.
The problem is they are such a big and powerful country.
Yes, but what we do, the second point is this. I think Malaysia is sticking to an ASEAN centrality way of dealing with China on South China Sea. There are one or two countries who well, China is actually asking each and every of the 10 ASEAN member states. Well, not all of them are dealing with South China Sea, not Myanmar, for example. So China is asking if each and every country can discuss on a bilateral basis. One or two countries have done it, but none of these one or two countries has also said that we are not going to do it on an ASEAN level. But Malaysia has strongly being very steadfast in the sense that we always tell Beijing that we will only discuss South China Sea on a group basis. So we are not going to do it bilateral. I mean, not that we don't, not that when Wang Yi, Minister Wang Yi, asked me about South China Sea, I would say, hey, brother, let's not talk about it. I mean, it's not that rigid. We can discuss, but official discussion on South China Sea, in as far as Malaysia is concerned, has to be done in a group, ASEAN and Beijing.
Dato, can the US be a counterbalancing force in this area?
Well, Thailand would be the best country in the region to play this balancing act.
Not
the
US?
We try. I think as far as Malaysia and ASEAN is concerned, we look at both superpowers and we tell them, look, we understand who you are, where you're coming from, what your intentions are. The major thing is that we do not want any one of them or any other parties for that matter to escalate matters. I think the term that we always tell people is do not escalate matters. And even on China, for example, we are trying to convince them that, yes, UNCLOS, the United Nations law governing the sea, allows for people to pass by, even your battleships. But you don't harbor, but you can pass. But with China, what is interesting is that because they claim they have their 9-dash line which come to yes. our shores, especially in Sarawak, they send their coastal, coastal boat patrol. Yeah, the problem with their boat is that the size of the boat sometimes is bigger than our Navy vessels. And I keep on telling my counterpart, you know, even if you want to send your coastal boat, you know, can't you have smaller boats? I mean, jokingly, we told them, you know, because the thing is this, you create some kind of tension,
yep.
you know, when you send your Coast Guard boat, big size, painted white, which is a universal color for Coast Guard boat, but so huge, bigger than our Navy ships. So you are very, you know, you give that kind of sense of tension, and we keep on telling them this are the thing that should not happen.
Now, the US, of course, has a presence in Taiwan, right? Perhaps they can send some aircraft carriers there, which would be much bigger than boats. And of course, that would be trouble. But they have a Taiwan policy. And can the U.S. use Southeast Asia as a strategy to deal with the problems of the wider area as well? What does your policy framework, how does it respond to that?
Well, we know the superpowers will come here. And, you know, this is their... one of their, well, not their playground, but Southeast Asia has always been an area where superpowers like to come, not only for business, but also to exert their influence, political influence. And this is geopolitics, of course. We know that. We are aware of that. And we keep on telling them that, you know, everyone is welcome to trade. We want to trade with all countries, regardless of their background. But please, South China Sea must be a sea that is free for everyone. You can pass by, but we want this area to be known as a region of peace and for people to trade.
Datuk, Singapore is also somewhat a challenge for Malaysia, and Malaysia wants to renegotiate water prices set out in the 1962 Water Agreement, which will lapse in 2061. That's a few years away. And this agreement gives Singapore the right to buy 250 million gallons of water a day from the Johor River at 3 cents per every 1,000 gallons. Now, Daim has also reiterated his call, saying that Johor has the right to review the price of water sold to Singapore after 25 years. How do you go about renegotiating an agreement that Singapore has more or less has a view that this is watertight, no pun intended?
Well, for a long, long time, Singapore has said that this is non-negotiable. But after the first meeting between our Prime Minister and the Singapore Prime Minister last year, they agreed that both AG would sit down, and both AGs have sat down. And well, at least now we are talking to each other on water agreement. In the last meeting in Putrajaya, this was on the table. And I would say that we are making some inroads, at least in the sense that this issue is now on the table. Previously, it was not even on the table. As far as Malaysia is concerned, we are now moving into the second phase of the discussion, i.e. to discuss the price modality. Singapore has not agreed that we should now start talking about price modality. They have other way of looking at it. But at least, as I said, it is already on the table, and I think that is something positive about it.
And Singapore said that the treatment cost of the water is 240, while we sell it to them at 3 cents, and then they sell about 1,000 gallons back to Johor. Mm-hmm. Sorry, they sell back to Johor at 395 per gallon of Johor sells it at 395. Is there a price that we have in mind when we renegotiate?
We have. Unfortunately, I'm not able to share with you now. Yes.
Okay, we'll come back. We're going to break for news now, and we'll continue with the discussion. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
We have on the Breakfast Grill Dato' Saifuddin Abdullah, Foreign Affairs Minister. And Dato', earlier on we were talking about China and Singapore, and now just want to move to Rome. Malaysia failed to ratify the Rome Statute and, mm-hmm. of course, the ICERT as well. And you have vowed to call the bluff of the so-called Kangkung professors, whom you said misrepresented the people. And you also previously cited the deep state as a reason for why the government U-turned on the Rome Statute. Is this still a concern for you, the deep state?
Well, we have a new IGP, and I think that is something very positive. He has announced that he is for the formation of IPCMC. Now, that is a very important step towards arresting this issue regarding deep state. Please don't get me wrong, I'm not citing that the police is part of it, but what happened to the current IGP when he was in the wilderness, if you like, is an example of how a deep state can work. And
can you explain a little bit more details on what
deep state involve many elements. It could be the authority, it could be the system, it could be certain quarters, it might also include some greedy corporate captains who wants to work in a certain way. Say, for example, there is a new government coming in. And the new government is, like the current administration, we are very strong in our fight against corruption. But if you believe that you have made it because of corruption, you work within a certain structure and framework, and you try to sabotage the new administration. Now, if we can identify exactly who they are the deep state, you know, and we should, you know, expose them. Because just like we have to expose some of the academics who tend to manipulate facts and information, I'm all for differences, contestation of ideas. is good for democracy, is good for Malaysia, is good for everyone. But there is a huge difference between a healthy contestation of ideas and people who manipulate facts.
So are steps afoot now to ratify the Rome Statute?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have to withdraw. I've already asked my my officers in New York to withdraw, which is really unfortunate. But we will continue explaining the Rome Statute. We are still committed to rectify some of the other international human rights convention. But we learned from ICERT and the Rome Statute that we should put our communication strategy properly before we start doing this. We didn't expect that there are some people who go out of the way to they basically do some kind of fear-mongering to the extent that people become confused and people become so scared in the first instance was ICERT, second was, of course, the Rome Statute.
Yeah, Dato, how are you going to strengthen your communication strategy? Because mm-hmm. The optics between Pakatan Harapan members, even cabinet members, didn't look really good. And also ICERT, was ICERT as a result of this lack of communication, a missed opportunity for racial harmony?
ICERT, we didn't plan to do ICERT. I always say ICERT was hijacked from our agenda. We didn't plan to do ICERT first. So we were not prepared for that.
But in terms of communications...
We were more prepared for the Rome Statute. Yes.
So in terms of the signals that are being sent mm-hmm. out, would ICERT be ideal to foster racial unity and racial harmony?
Well, it would. But it is very unfortunate that, we have to put a stop to it, at least for now. The government has decided we're not going to ratify it. So that's very unfortunate. But we are looking at other areas. I mean, there are a couple of things here. Number one, I think Weta Multi and Mujahid, my two colleagues in the cabinet, they are working hard on a new, myself indirectly involved. Of course, there's Minister VK Liu. We are looking at a new set of legislation called the Harmony Act or the National Harmony Act. Now, this is something which I think is very much needed. First among others, because we really have to address this hate speech element. Hate speech is actually on the rise, and we have to address it. And we can't wait so long. The thing is, we are not in favor of using Sedition Act. It has a lot of baggage, and the threshold for sedition under the Sedition Act, or at least in its convention, has been very low. So we have to address hate speech. In fact, I always say it's no longer hate speech nowadays. It's like hate spin already. It's gone worse. We really have to address it. So even without ICERT, we have to address this hate speech or hate spin.
And recently, Tun Dr. Mahathir also unveiled the Shared Prosperity of mm-hmm. 2030. And this just feels like a rehash or an extension of the Wawasan 2020, which, apart from its economic objectives, also wanted to create a liberal, tolerant and progressive society. In Shared Prosperity 2030, are we holding... How can we show the rakyat that we are actually holding on to those values?
I think there are a couple. There are at least two things. Number one is to actually do things better, to put it simply. But number two, along the way, we have also to look at the way we do politics in this country. To me, the biggest political problem in the country is politics of race. It has been there for so long, to the extent that some people don't even think that it is a problem. Some actually thrive on it. Some benefit from it. And the moment you say you want to put an end to politics of race, you become a problem. And they start accusing you of being westernized, liberal, and so on and so forth. But there's no two way about it. We have to address it. And I think the results of our past three general elections show that we are on the way to do it, but we have to ensure that there is sufficient motivation for the people and the political parties, including politicians, to do it. And I think we can. For example, within Pakatan Harapan, three of the four political parties are multiracial in whatever level. You might say Keadilan is probably a real full-fledged multiracial party. But at least there are three multiracial parties, and that include Amanah. Most people forget that, number one, Amanah is progressive. Number two, they have their own chapter or wing for non-Muslim membership. Now, number two, the people seems to be able to differentiate between shallow racist politics and a more open, robust, and healthy multiracial politics. The way people vote shows that the trend is really for or towards multiracial politics. The only thing is the system. Using Ong Kia Meng's calculation, if the Election Commission, in its last delimitation, were truthful to their work, but they were corrupt, they were using all kinds of gerrymandering and malapportionment strategies, we now have 83 mixed seats among the 222 parliamentary seats. If the EC were truthful, we should have about 140. Pakatan Harapan won 73 out of those 83 seats. And if the coming delimitation process, which will come only in, I think, 2025, 8 years after 2017, we should be getting more mixed seats. So the people are ready. Most of the political parties in Pakatan Harapan are ready. If the system were to motivate politicians to campaign on the cross-ethnic and cross-religious agenda, then you have all the three major ingredients toward putting an end to racism and politics of race.
Dato, as a final question, to tell you our poll results. We have a poll running asking the question of whether you're satisfied with Malaysia's foreign policy direction. 52%, half of the voters, saying that they don't know whether we have a direction. And an extra 23% said no, they're not satisfied. So almost 75, three quarters of the people there are not satisfied. What message have you got to tell these folks?
Well, I don't blame them, because more often than not, foreign policy is seen as a jet-setting policy. And that is why from day one, when I came to the ministry, I said that foreign policy begins at home. That foreign policy is an extension of whatever things that we do in the country. So I'm not shocked with your finding. I think it is a fair impression on what people think about foreign policy, because as I said earlier, most people don't really know what we do, and that is why I sometimes have to. Among the things that we do is we even do our own roadshow, going to universities, going to meeting people, and trying to explain. You know, what we do is not what you see on TV. those are just the optics. Those are just the PR that we have to do. But many of the things that we do are behind closed doors, and unfortunately, sometimes we can't actually reveal what we do and what we intend to do. But in a nutshell, foreign policy begins at home.
Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to speak to you again sometime in the future. And that was Datuk Saifuddin Abdullah, Minister of the Foreign Affairs, on this morning's Breakfast Grill. I'm Julian Ng, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with faster speeds every day. Barulah best.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.